You're listening to the Unsure Entrepreneur Podcast with Roger Pearce. Whether you're scribbling business ideas on a napkin or wrestling with the should I, shouldn't I question, get ready to explore the realities, the risks and the rewards of entrepreneurship as we share the stories, scars and successes of small business owners.
Hello and welcome to the Unsure Entrepreneur Podcast. I'm your host, Roger Pearce. Thanks for joining us. I'm so excited for you to meet our guest today and learn about his journey into entrepreneurship. Patrick McCauley is a seasoned PR expert and founder of Pointman News Creation, known for his innovative media strategies and successful PR campaigns for a diverse range of clients across North America. With a background in television news and over 20 years of communications experience, Patrick excels in creating media coverage that stands out and believes that the best idea wins. Welcome, Patrick. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Thank you. Quite an introduction. Appreciate it.
I'm so glad to have you here. And we're going to dig into your background first. You know, the podcast is all about helping people understand your journey into entrepreneurship. So maybe you can start by going back, 21 years to when you transitioned from a journalist into entrepreneur. Can you tell us more?
So there was a brief stop of PR in between. I have worked at three of the four national broadcasters in Canada on the assignment desk, meaning that I'm the guy that was sitting there getting really bad pitches from big agencies. A lot of uninspiring things, but ultimately decided what made it on the air and what didn't for a lot of the national news broadcasts. I remember I had this epiphanal moment at some point when I was working one of those horrible midnight until 8 a.m. shifts that it'd probably be smarter to be a PR person than the guy that's sending out the camera and telling the chopper where to go to get a, see a fire. And it sounds a lot more exciting than it is. There's a lot of boredom and council meetings, and a lot of the stuff that happens in a day in broadcast news is not terribly exciting, with few exceptions. So I kind of said, okay, I'm going to get into PR because, yeah, like I know exactly what the media is looking for. I have that incredible insight. And the problem with that was that PR agencies had no idea what to do with me because I didn't have PR experience, which is the thing that they value. But I also wasn't a beginner because I'd been, you know, about 5 years working in broadcast. So I'm not being hyperbolic. I think I had about 120 job interviews to get a job in public relations. And I ended up eventually getting a job at a small independent firm for about 2 years I worked. And then I started Pointman News Creation.
Wow. That's quite a background. Maybe jumping ahead here now, so people understand some context about what you do and what exactly is a news creation agency. I know you've got a distinction between publicity and public relations and news creation. So can you give me some insight, for example, how you came up with some of these innovative campaigns like the Real Cost of Love survey or some of the other great stuff that you've done?
Primarily, I try to do things that I think are funny. So I almost think of myself as a humorist to a certain extent. My whole approach is the Trojan horse. So a lot of the time, you know, I'm working with like an insurance company or a financial advisor or a company that doesn't really have anything incredibly interesting to talk about or say that's going to get the media's attention. And in these times when, you know, basically the world is burning, the world is melting, you have to do something really different to break through. So a lot of the time, the ideas just start off with something that I personally think is funny. Sometimes my wife has a comment on something and I expand that into a whole campaign. Like she's a very creative person as well. And this was for a company that was a rate comparison site for credit cards and how much things cost and getting the best deals on things. And I just thought it'd be hilarious as a kind of anti-Valentine's Day thing to look at how much a relationship actually costs. So we, you know, crunched numbers, we looked at it, we did like $1,200 in apology flowers because, you know, you're going to need that. And like a new wardrobe because likely your partner's not going to appreciate your style. We crunched all those numbers together and it came out to like $12,904.03, which was just hilarious, the rounding at the end. That was a really successful campaign. And we kept doing that every year. So it was like, oh, your relationship's going to cost you 10% more, 10% less, or so the real cost of love, you know, that kind of thing.
I love it. That's one of my favorites. Another favorite of yours is the Dump, Drop, Tie campaign. Can you give us some behind the scenes on that?
So this was a guy who was on Bay Street in Toronto, had a lot of Bay Street financial guy clients. There's a menswear store, upscale menswear store, right across from Harry Rosen, actually, right on Bay Street. And he wanted to do something to get like huge visibility for the store. God, it was 2013 or something or 14. So Trump was running for president. And again, this is my own bias. I really have tried to do some anti-Trump stuff and just thought it'd be funny to do a tie that was an anti-Trump tie. Now, in fairness to him, he had already planned to do that, but it was the perfect thing. We both kind of came up with the same idea at the same time. And it's basically, it's a tie that had dump trucks on the front. And then like on the back part, the skinny part of the tie, it said Dump Trump. So it's kind of like the headline wrote itself to a certain extent. It was, are you an undercover Trump dumper? I defy any media person in the world to not respond to that as a humor sort of campaign. And at the time, there was a lot of people on Bay Street that thought Trump was great. They were like, hey, I wish he was our prime minister, you know, because he's doing all these great things. This is before P-Gate. This is before like the 9 things that he's wanted criminally for. And that one was lightning in a bottle. It was crazy from the beginning. Every Canadian outlet did something. It got into the U.S. on U.S. television. I think it was 350-something media hits. And actually, the client at some point said, can you make this stop? Because I've sold all the ties within 3 days, $20,000 worth of ties. And like, I need to move on with my life and I can't keep doing media interviews. So I guess that's a benchmark of success that you kind of want to have. But that one's, again, sort of a humor thing, but yeah, really lightning in a bottle.
It worked too well.
Yeah, well, that can happen.
It's a nice problem to have. But this is what's so cool about what you do and what makes Point Man News Creation so unique. You know, you've got this background in journalism and you know how to create these compelling PR pitches. Can you share how that journalism thinking helps you do your job now?
I always call it the appropriate cynicism. I think that one of the things, and there are many that are wrong with most PR people/agencies, is that they have this fear of the media that, oh my God, I can't do something funny. I can't do something interesting. I can't do something clever. I can't use alliteration because the media is so clever that they're not going to respond to it and they're smarter than we are. And it's a weird thing that I've never understood because I was that guy. I know. I even do this when I'm doing media training for people. I have a slide of me in like 1998 looking really tired in a group photo from the Global TV set with all the anchors and everything. And I say, like, you gotta get that guy who's like half asleep and has no life and is working midnight until 8 a.m. to get excited about your pitch. So it better be something interesting. It better be something that is amusing this guy because his life probably isn't that great. He's not getting a lot of sleep. He's probably got like some kind of weird daytime, nighttime dysmorphia thing going on. That's who you have to appeal with. God, there's like hundreds, if not thousands, of pitches coming into that guy every day. Everyone thinks it's about, I know a guy at the Globe and he'll do a story because we're friends. No one's going to do a story because they like you. Media relations is probably the last meritocracy in the world. You have to have the best idea on the best day. A lot of pressure. It's very hard to do that, but you have to come up with brilliant ideas and you have to have confidence in them.
Okay, so on that note, and I've seen entrepreneurs, and I've been maybe guilty of this before in my marketing agency days, of coming up with an angle thinking, oh, the media is going to love this. It's going to get lots of coverage. So having seen both great and disastrous idea pitches, what advice would you give to entrepreneurs to try to stand out?
The problem is it's almost impossible for you to be objective about your own news. That's why people have like a fintech solution and they have like a new product update and they think it's the greatest thing that's ever happened in the history of mankind. No one cares, man. No one's going to do a commercial for you unless you pay for it. That's advertising. And yes, the line between earned media and advertising has gotten very thin. But generally speaking, no one cares about your product update. No one cares that you have a robust solution that blah, blah, blah. You have to do something legitimately interesting on its own and related back to what you do somehow. So that's the Trojan horse approach. It's like, let's do something that's independently newsworthy that the media can't ignore, that cleverly relates back to what you do as a company or a product or a service.
Excellent point. A lot of entrepreneurs think, I've got a 25% off sale. Let's get this out to the media. To which you say, and I know the line, you know, that's not news, that's advertising. Know the difference. Can you expand on that? A lot of people are confused by those differences.
And it's confusing. So I'll admit that. I only do earned media because I don't think you should have to pay for it. That's one of my principles that I really insist on with clients. A lot of agencies now are doing kind of a mix of things where they'll do an earned media pitch, but they're also doing some paid advertorial stuff in various publications. Maybe they're working with influencers, whatever. So I'm not saying that those things don't have value. I'm not saying that those aren't things that are worth doing. I'm not suggesting that earned media PR is the solution to every problem. But I think if you approach it the right way, you can absolutely get earned media. And it has the potential of being viral and getting you a lot of media coverage. So because there's the least number of media in history doing the most content, they're desperate for something interesting. If anyone listening just wants to Google, like, is the press release dead? I bet you can find 3 pages of Google results that say it is. That doesn't mean that that's true, because media is still looking for good content, interesting stories that are delivered to them in a way that they can just cut and paste. So I could literally show you 50 examples of where I've written a press release in a certain way that is, I mean, the magic's in the details, but that gets media attention, that is kind of ready to roll, and they just basically cut and paste it into a story that becomes a national story in an online publication. And that's great. That's fantastic as a PR person and as a company. If this show isn't about the veracity of journalism and the quality of journalism in Canada, then all I can say is it's great when somebody takes your story from a press release. It's exactly how you wanted to position yourself, and they put it into a story. Recent example of that, I was doing something for a client that does mortgage training for mortgage agents, and clever turn of phrase, we called it mortgage malaise. Alliteration is the key to the universe. So media people are generally people who appreciate words and subtleties and alliterations and stuff. So you're trying to come up with something that's catchy to get their attention. And it was a pretty basic pitch. It was a poll that we did online, asking questions about people's mortgages. And we found that only a third of Canadians were happy with their mortgages. And then I called it mortgage malaise. Again, people listening, if you're still Googling things, Google mortgage malaise and see how many media hits come up and how many media outlets in Canada I got to say that in the story. Because it's clever. It's kind of a cool concept that there's mortgage malaise. It's talking about a trend and a condition. And we backed it up with a survey that said that only a third of people are happy with their mortgages. And then the client, the mortgage training people, get a ton of media attention. A lot of it was really just cut and paste, you know, as I was saying, but the client got interviewed, I think, at least 5 times by different outlets. And then that got shared. And I think we netted out with about 150 media hits. And I actually just got an international award for that from NYX.
Wow. Congrats.
Thank you.
That's awesome. And so many points there for entrepreneurs to understand when they're looking to get some media coverage. The first one is work with a professional like you.
Yes. You can't be objective about your own media relations. It's impossible. I can't even be objective about my own media relations.
And like you said, the landscape has changed. I mean, I'm dating myself here, but I can remember faxing news releases out to the local TV and radio and hoping they cover it.
Like reading faxes and sorting faxes.
but now it's a digital world. It's a viral landscape. It's changed things, doesn't it?
Absolutely. News travels fast. Information flows quickly. It's so much opportunity to get massive media coverage for something. I mean, so great example. This week, I did something for an insurance company that sells business insurance. And we did a survey on how Canadians are more willing to sue than they were 5 years ago. So the idea being that we're becoming more litigious like Americans, and it's un-Canadian. That was the big word, was un-Canadian to do this. That one, yeah, like got picked up by, the first one was the Toronto Sun, and then that gets blasted to every Sun website online, and then every post-media publication. So I mean, like the Coldwater Times and like the Kingston Whig Standard and places you haven't heard of, like the Tillsonburg Humberview Outlook. We're at like 100 media hits for that, all of which have a link back to the company, Zensurance, if I can do a little plug there. From one media hit where someone really kind of cut and pasted the content of the press release, went off the press release to write the story, never talked to us, which is great, like 100 media hits. So significant return.
Brilliant. It's great to hear all these different places picking up the news you've created. So I'm going to go back 21 years. Was there a pivotal moment during your time in the news industry that influenced your decision to pivot to PR and start Point Man News Creation?
I sort of have two stories for that. One is really sad and one is really basic. Which one do you want me to tell you?
Whatever one you think is most insightful.
I would say generally, I realized at some point that it wasn't going to happen for me. No one goes to journalism school and gets a job in broadcast, which is very hard. It was really hard 21 years ago. It's harder now, but it's a very tough place to work for a lot of reasons. And I was, you know, on the assignment desk. I got a job at some point as a researcher. I actually moved back to the assignment desk so that I could do daytime interviews so that I could get out of there. That was kind of the plan. It was very clear to me that I wasn't going to get a break to be a reporter for whatever reason. I probably wasn't going to get a break to be a producer. It's not a terribly highly paid position. I would call it a pretty toxic work environment, more so 21 years ago. There's probably a little bit more political correctness, but I think it's still just a really hard place to work. Something I heard like the first week that I worked at Global TV was, this is a business for the young. And I was like 24 years old and I hated that. I was like, well, don't you tell me that it's a business for the young, you know, like old man. I think that that's actually really true. I think that it's, you have to have those incredible ideals where you think that you're the keeper of the knowledge and you have to believe in what you're doing. And there's going to be a day, if you work in a newsroom, where you actually figure out, if you're an intelligent person, how the donuts are made. You know, you're going to see the advertising kind of come in to the positive story that they do about something that's a non-event, or you're going to see a political bias that you don't agree with that's going to cause you unhappiness. And I think once you realize that you're selling soap, but you work in a really cool place on the outside that sells soap, it's a little bit soul crushing. It sounds like the greatest job ever. So many people I know have gone through this where can't wait to tell people at a party that you work at Global Television or CTV National News or something, because that's cool. Then you get to a point where you don't want to really tell anyone because you're embarrassed of, once you know how it really works and the compromises that people have to make in news, you're like, I work, in television. You don't really want to talk about it. And, you know, that day came. Other reasons too, being an assignment editor, you're sending cameras to shootings and accidents and horrible things. You know, you have to be, like they say this in the first day of journalism school, you have to be willing to send a reporter to the house of parents whose four-year-old kid has died and ask for pictures. And I did that more than once, and I didn't want to do that anymore.
So was that the catalyst to get into your own thing?
I think that was the catalyst for wanting to get into PR. The catalyst for wanting to do my own thing and like be entrepreneurial. It's funny. It kind of started when I had that like 120 job interviews because no one was hiring me, but everyone wanted to talk to me because I was an assignment editor. I was literally the guy they were calling to make decisions. So halfway through this process, it occurs to me, well, if they're not going to hire me, maybe I can just get money from them for telling them how to pitch. So I started doing lunch and learns. And I think I made more from that the couple of years that I was doing it than from my actual job in broadcasting. I charged like $1,000 and I'd be like, yeah, I'm going to tell you how to pitch and who does what and what you're doing wrong. And yeah, I'll come in and I'll do a lunch and learn. So sorry you're not hiring me to be a PR guy, but hey, I'm going to tell you how to do PR anyway. So that was the entrepreneurial start. And that really got me excited about it. And then I was kind of done with the agency I was working at for a variety of reasons. Felt like I hadn't learned a ton and it wasn't really going anywhere. And there were some human rights issues that I had. Yeah, I was seeing the daylight. I had a regular life to a certain extent and I made a lot more money, but it just didn't seem like it was what I wanted to do. And my wife calls us the bait and switch when we first got together. I was on the third interview at a really major Canadian insurance company to be their like head of PR. That would have been a really, you know, high paid C-suite kind of job. And she thought that's what I was going to do. One day I kind of came home and she had just, it was the 2001. So it was like the tech bubble burst. She was at a graphic design company that went under. She's like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to start my own company, because she didn't have any other options. And then I came home one day and I said, you know what? I'm going to quit my job too. At the time, I actually wanted to do a like a video company, which was incredibly unsuccessful, actually. The first venture that I did with a couple of friends from high school. And yeah, she calls it the bait and switch, because it was kind of like she thought I was going to be bringing home the paycheck. But we both kind of at the same time jumped off a cliff together and said, yeah, we're just going to do the entrepreneurial thing because life is short and 9/11 just happened and the world's telling us we need to be brave. And so whether that was a good idea or a bad idea, we're like a 23-year overnight success.
That's a whole other podcast right there. Husband and wife, entrepreneurs, yeah, working as entrepreneurs, but separately in their own businesses. I know you guys do it very well. I'm hoping to get your wife on the podcast soon.
Yes, she's as well.
But that's a great angle. I'll have to shelve that one for another episode. Did you raise the money for your business, Patrick, from those training and consulting sessions, or how did you get the seed money to get things going?
What money? Are you supposed to have money when you start a business?
Of course not.
Yeah, I had negligible savings and just started the company on a whim because it really seemed like the right thing to do. One of us should have had a real job, probably. We just kind of started it without really a budget or a business plan or much of anything other than like we have the ability to do this and we have to make it work somehow.
Bootstrapping.
Yeah. There was no investment or budget or here's $20,000 to coast, or we didn't even have a loan or anything either. It was some very lean years in the beginning just to sort of make rent and keep going. But at some point we'd invested so much emotionally in it and worked so hard on it, we just couldn't refused to not let it be a success. And somehow that's carried us to 2024 and arguably being a pretty good success, both of our companies.
And here you are. And what you said about starting off with zero or very little money is so true for a service-based business. And I always preach this to entrepreneurs. You know, 75% of businesses in North America are service-based. They're the less expensive option to start up than, say, retail or manufacturing, which requires a lot of overhead and risk. And who's got that? So I love it when I hear about a service-based business because you can get going for relatively little. So,
yeah, exactly. Intellectual property. Yes, you can get screwed out of your intellectual property, but the only thing is your time and your ideas. I don't have to keep fresh cakes that I have to sell every week. The prospect of opening a restaurant or having something with perishable goods or things, physical things that I have to sell is terrifying. I would never do that.
It's a bigger risk. So just watching our clock here too, I want to delve a bit into what entrepreneurship means to you. Can you tell me how has being a small business owner changed you personally and some of the lessons you've learned about yourself along the way?
It was inevitable. If I take stock of my my educational history and being the guy who got kicked out of a few schools when he was a kid, and my mother would tell you my attitude problem. It came in handy for journalism too, but I'm not a conventional follower type. So you have to have that kind of resilience. If I really cared what everyone thought all the time and I was a people pleaser, then I don't think it would have been as easy to be an entrepreneur, because you have to believe in what you're doing and your moral compass and your ability. You almost have to be profoundly confident or pretend to be. I hate the whole fake it till you make it thing, but the truth is that you start off, and I mean, I remember my first actually paid gig. It was for a cafe in Forest Hill Village in Toronto, very upscale. We had an event and I thought it was a great idea. It was to be Canada's first free wireless village offering free internet, which, kids, you can Google this, but like back in 2001 was kind of a big deal. You'd had to actually pay for it most of the time. We had an event and I really didn't know if I was full of crap until the first journalist got there. And then I was like, okay, well, maybe I do know what I'm talking about. So you have to have that bravado of youth. You have to have that belief in yourself that you can do it. Made a lot of mistakes along the way. I've had successful things and unsuccessful things, but I think I kind of swung for the fence and said, I'm going to be that guy, and somehow got there through accomplishment and things that worked and things that didn't work. I mean, I went to journalism school. I didn't know business principles or how to deal with clients or really sales. Everyone thinks like, hey, I went to university or I went to college, so I'm not going to have to do sales. That's just stupid. The world is sales. No matter who you are, no matter what you do, you're selling something. And this notion that entrepreneurs have that you're just going to be like the guy who sits in the chair like Moses, I'm dating myself, Moses Neimer, and like has profound ideas and someone else is doing all the selling and you're just collecting a paycheck for being brilliant. That's not going to happen, man. You have to be able to sell. And that's of anything, no matter what you do, if you're going to be an entrepreneur, that's the thing that you need to understand how to do. Like our friend Andrew Jenkins was a used car salesman. That's done him. So he's an entrepreneur. He's got his own social media company. That's done him the most good probably of anything, Rotman MBA aside. I think that fundamental ability to sell that he learned when he was selling cars is very much part of his success.
That's a great piece of advice for aspiring entrepreneurs. Be prepared to sell. Nothing sells itself.
Yeah, get a job selling anything. So you learn how to get
that training. Yeah, I love it. And great ideas on their own still need to be carried to the customer in the form of sales.
Sure.
Before we wrap up, I would love to get, you know, one thing you love and one thing you hate about being an entrepreneur.
I love that at this point, 23 or so years in, I can say no. That's not a luxury that you have at the beginning. So you have to work with your moral compass as much as you can to work with the best people that you can at the beginning. Now I'm in a position where I say no more than I say yes. And I'm very careful about who I work with. And, you know, I joke, like people say, who's your ideal client? I always say like people who have money and will listen to me. But that's only partially true. Those are prerequisites as well. But they have to do something that I don't think is wrong or abhorrent, or I don't like their attitude about something or their political stance or whatever. So it's great to be in a position where I can try to use my powers for good and work with people that I think are ethical and like-minded that are doing good things or just need promotion to try to sell something that's fundamentally a good product. So that's great. I don't know what else I would do. I'm older and more cynical, and every once in a while, just for fun, I try to imagine how many times I would have been fired or laid off if I'd stayed in broadcasting. Global TV went bankrupt about 10 years after I worked there and has changed hands. And every week, you know, media is getting laid off. It's a horrible place to be. So I don't think that was my best destiny.
What do you dislike? What should you warn entrepreneurs about?
Getting bullied by clients. I mean, I don't really let it happen anymore and haven't for some time. Part of my job is literally telling billionaires that they're wrong, because they're, and I do it more than you think. They're like, well, this is the most amazing thing that's ever happened. And our upgrade is, you know, and it's like, no, dude, no one cares. Sorry. I've been on a call. I just had this weekly call with a billionaire and there'd be 10 people on the phone call and no one would say anything except me and him. There'd be like 10 people just listening. Oh my God, I hope I don't have to say anything. Please don't ask me anything. And I'm like, guys, surely you agree this is not the way to do this because it's not newsworthy. Nothing, just like crickets. So I don't love that. I don't love someone telling me what's newsworthy. I'm not for everyone. And I try to qualify people to see if they're going to go outside their box. But if you're not willing to do something that makes you maybe a little uncomfortable, then we probably shouldn't work together because you're going to have to do that in order to make it newsworthy.
That's very profound. So look for a fit, a client fit.
Make everything that you publicly put out about yourself a strong indicator of what it's like to work with you and what you're about. So I would say my website, pointmannc.com, my job title, Vanquisher of Vanilla PR, pretty much all of my marketing and everything that I say and all my case studies and whatever, give you a pretty good flavor for what you're in for. So like if you want to do the vanilla approach and you want to do like the typical like, hey, what's really interesting about you and your company and your product? And let's send out a press release and see what happens. And thanks for the bag of money. Sorry that didn't work out. I'm not your guy. I'm going to push you to an uncomfortable place because I know that's what you need to do to get media coverage. And at the end of the day, public relations is pointless if you don't get media coverage. You can send out the best press release in the world, according to you. If it doesn't get media coverage, you failed.
Terrific answer. Thank you for sharing that. Well, I could talk to you all day, my friend, but that's all the time we have. I want to thank you very much, Patrick McCauley, Point Man News Creation, for sharing your entrepreneurial journey and experiences with us. It means a lot to me and our listeners. Before you go, if someone wants to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Patrick@pointmannc.com. I don't answer the phone, so send me an email.
I love it. And the website is, again?
pointmannc.com.
Wonderful. Thanks again, Patrick. And to our listeners, thank you for being here. And be sure to return for more insights from the Unsure Entrepreneur. Bye for now.
That's it for this episode of the Unsure Entrepreneur podcast. Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss other candid conversations with small business owners. And be sure to check us out at unsureentrepreneur.com.